Will Longdon boiled his silk thread over the kitchen stove, and Moulin stood ready to use his strength to hold the young man down, should the apothecary's mixture not take hold soon enough.
"You have brought a curse on this town," one of those in the growing crowd called, "and pain and death will be inflicted in return."
Blackstone and the others looked to see who had cried out, but the shuffling crowd hemmed in whoever had cursed them.
"Get back to your homes," Renfred ordered. "How many of us will you kill before we obey?"
the woman snarled.
"How many will die before you run?" said Gilbert. "Get back to your rat-holes, you vermin, or I will come among you."
Renfred signalled for some of his men to move in on the crowd, who quickly dispersed before any violence could be inflicted on them. Blackstone pulled the butcher to him. He took the meat cleaver and the saw from him, and placed the bone saw on the table. "It needs a clean cut. If you hack the bone, it will splinter." The man nodded dumbly, as he looked down at the young man who sweated and shivered on the table. Will Longdon raised the infected leg and placed a block of wood beneath it. He tied the cord above and below the wound. Blackstone pulled free the butcher's knives and examined them. The paring knife had the keenest blade. "When you pare a pig's haunch, you cut through skin and muscle and pull the skin back?" The butcher nodded. "Then, when you remove the bone, there is enough skin remaining so that a cook can pack herbs and spices before threading with string and cooking."
"Yes, my lord," said the butcher feebly.
"And that is what you will do here. Leave enough flesh to stitch over the cut bone," said Blackstone.
"Keep your hands steady. Saw cleanly." The men gathered around the stricken Frenchman. Each had a role to play. The apothecary lifted Alain's head and poured wine mixed with the opiate liquid between his lips.
"I am uncertain how much to administer," he said. "Too much, and I will kill him before you begin to cut. Too little, and the pain will not be sufficiently blocked."
He stepped back and nodded at Blackstone.
"I dare not give him more."
Alain de la Grave's breathing and tremors eased. Blackstone nodded to Moulin, who lent his strength against the lad's shoulders. Blackstone stood opposite the butcher and held the broken, infected leg. The butcher licked his lips nervously. A moment of calm settled as everyone waited for the cutting to start. A sudden flurry of crows fluttered from the chateau's roof, their cawing alarm startling everyone. A bad sign.
"Do it," said Blackstone to the frightened butcher.
"Put your mind to it and cut."
"Where?"
Blackstone touched a hand's breadth above the swollen, pus-filled wound and poisoned tendrils, and a finger's width below where Longdon had tightened the cord. The butcher hesitated, took a deep breath, and bent to the task. Alain's unconscious body bucked slightly as the curved blade found nerves. The man cut with the expertise a butcher learns over the years. A bucket on the floor at the end of the table caught the blood that quickly swamped his hands. The butcher looked startled for a moment, being more used to butchering dead animals. Blackstone saw the look of alarm as he raised his eyes.
"Quickly now, the bone," said Blackstone.
The butcher wiped his bloody hand on his apron and picked up the bone saw. Blackstone reached across and tugged back the flap of skin, exposing the bone, giving the butcher a clear view of what had to be done. The saw moved back and forth. The pain must have reached deep into the young man's unconsciousness, because despite the opiate, he suddenly bucked and tried to rear up. Moulin and Blackstone held him down, but a low cry of agony reached out to them all, and then he fell back.
"Finish it,"
Blackstone commanded the butcher, as the apothecary placed a hand on the lad's chest and then placed his face close to his mouth.
"He still lives!"
The leg came free. Gilbert reached for it and dropped it into an empty wood basket. Will Longdon shouldered the butcher aside. The man was dazed from his experience. The veteran archer swabbed the gaping wound with turpentine, and then, as Blackstone raised the stump to ease the bleeding, quickly stitched the flaps of skin over the cut. The apothecary's servant stepped forward with a pot of malleable clay. Blackstone dipped his hand into the pot and spread the contents thickly and evenly over the wound. The apothecary then placed a piece of clean linen over the clay and bandaged the leg. If they had been at prayer in the church and watched the marked candle burn down, they would have known that it had taken less than 2 minutes from the moment the first cut had been made. The men stood back from their efforts. A lone crow dropped silently from the roof and settled near the basket, its crippled gait taking it closer to the severed leg. Kilbert moved so quickly that the bird had no time to escape. His sword slashed down, and the bird fell dead. "We'll have no bad omens hovering near the lad," said Kilbert. "Have the leg taken to the blacksmith and burned," he instructed Tate, who in turn ordered one of his men forward. "Moulin, take him back to his cot. Master Apothecary, you and your servants stay with him a while," said Blackstone. "Butcher, you will be paid for your work here today." The butcher bowed his head and gathered his knives and saw. As Moulin lifted the unconscious Frenchman from the table, one of the men sluiced it with a bucket of water. Kilbert spat out the foul taste that the stench from the poisoned leg had left in his throat. "I'll go and kick the priest's ass and have him light a candle and offer up prayers." The men filtered away as Blackstone turned his face to a freshening breeze that blew across the lingering smell of blood and disease. The sooner they could leave this place, the better. He felt a tinge of regret. He had failed to tell Alain that his true father still lived, and it was from him that he gained his courage. Was it going to be too late? It seemed unlikely the lad would live, and if he did, what use could he be? There could be no employment as a soldier. What was left? A life of poverty, begging on a vermin-infested street in some town. Regret struck him. Why had he not let the boy die? He knew why. Because it had been his intent to avenge another youngster that had brought them to this murderous place. If a life could be spared from the slaughter that had occurred here, then it should be saved. Blackstone kicked the crow's bloodied remains into the courtyard below. Let it rot there, on the blood-soaked ground.
Chapter 55 Blackstone went into the chateau and the room he shared with Kilbert. He was covered with gore, from when Alain's heartbeat had pumped blood across him as the leg was taken. He stripped off his jupon and shirt and used the washbowl to sluice the blood from his hands, face and body, and rinsed water through his hair. As he turned to take a bolt of cloth to dry himself, he saw Countess Catherine in the doorway. Her dark hair had been curled and plaited, and the bruise on her face was covered with pale makeup. But she was dressed more simply than when he had first seen her. Still, her plain attire could do nothing to hide her beauty. She was barefoot and wore no rings on her hands or bracelets on her wrist. For someone like the Countess, it appeared to be an act of penance. She had approached so silently that he had not heard her, and he wondered whether she had a hidden knife. But the tightness of her gown would have made such concealment impossible. "You're confined to your quarters. I had your doors locked," he said. She stepped into the room, but did not approach him.
"There is more than one key," she answered, "and more than one door."
"What is it you want?" he said, without any warmth in his voice. He would not accord this woman any clemency that might still linger in his heart.
"Does the boy live?"
"Why should you care?"
"I took him to my bed. I enjoyed his youth. I did not wish to see such a beautiful body broken."
Blackstone pulled on his shirt. He had no wish to linger in the same room as this temptress, because that was surely what she was. And he could not deny the same urge he felt towards her as he had done in the beginning. "He's likely to die. The broken bones poisoned his blood, and we were forced to cut off his leg." She showed no sign of remorse.
"It is your actions that have resulted in his misfortune and brought death to my people," she said matter-of-factly. "We are both to blame, Sir Thomas. I, for wishing to avenge my own family by luring routiers here and killing them, and you for seeking the same vengeance on William Cade. I am no pious woman, as you know, but these circumstances were surely governed by God's hand."
"God favours no one in a battle. We all cry out his name to bless us and to keep us safe. He is deaf to our entreaties. It was not God who brought us together. There are other spirits of misfortune that punish us. I wanted only William Cade. I was going to leave this place without harm, but you have a lust for killing that is even more than your lust for sex.
And you condemn me for it?
She had taken another step closer, like an animal approaching a trap, cautious, but daring to test the danger of what lay ahead. Blackstone did not move. Sensing creature instincts were at play. Was she laying poisoned bait for him?
You know you will be hunted now. Those who escaped from Felice will have carried word of what you have done here.
Being hunted is nothing new to me or my men.
Your enemies increase every year you roam like a dispossessed ghost. You should stop and find a place that grants you safety, and a way to feed and clothe your men, and to make money with ease. There would be no need for you or your men to die when the French king or another routier leader finally traps you.
Blackstone gazed at her. He could not take his eyes from the hollow of her throat, where a rhythmic pulse beat. It had increased in its intensity, and a warm glow had seeped into her neck and face. He realized she was offering herself to him.
"You wish me to stay here?" he said.
She stepped yet closer. "I am a widow who must defend this town and this fiefdom. You have killed my garrison and many of my militia, so I cannot offer my people safety any longer. I need a man no one would dare challenge. And if that man had his own soldiers, then it would prove an agreeable arrangement."
"And you would wish me in your bed," he said gently, lowering his voice to match her inducement.
"I would welcome it," she said, "and you would become Lord of Felice."
He could smell her scent as she came within arm's reach. She was offering him lust and power, and yet she stood before him like an innocent, a virgin bride, demure before her husband.
"And I would have money," he said,
already tasting his desire for her.
"I have enough gold and silver coin, and more will come in patis once you offer your protection here and beyond,"
she said, her voice almost like a whisper from a lover.
"I would have to leave while I look for the Welshman I hunt. I don't know how long that would take."
He could feel her breath on his face. It smelled of sweet, scented herbs. He bent his lips to hers and touched them lightly. Like a huntress, she had drawn him in, and slowly she tightened the noose on her prey.
"Not long, not long, Thomas. He is in the mountains south of here. He camps at La Roche, Cade told me. Kill him, and come back to me."
Without haste, her tongue sought his, and for a moment he embraced her. So slow was the kiss, so delicate her tongue, it took little imagination to know how sweet the love-making would be. He held her a heartbeat longer. She raised her head and looked up into his smiling face, and then Blackstone tipped the jug of water over her. Drenched, she shrieked and shuffled back. Shock etched her face. She snarled and hurled herself at him, but he easily wrapped her arms around her, and her thrashing kicks had no effect on him.
"Be quiet, or you will be hurt," he warned her.
Her cries brought Moulin and two of his men to the door.
"Do as I say," he insisted, "or I give you to my men."
Her head sank as her struggles eased. He pushed the bedraggled woman away from him. She fought the men who grabbed her arms, but she was easily held. She spat at Blackstone as he pulled on his jupon.
"You are a bastard, scar-faced Englishman. You are a plague on France, and I wish to God that I could have hung your body in my courtyard."
Blackstone nodded. "And had you succeeded, your king and his son would have rewarded you with anything you had asked for," he said evenly.
"I admire a woman who will fight for justice. I've known women like that. I respect their courage. But you are not one of those women. At first I thought you were. You are twisted in heart and soul, and surely it will be that same God you proclaim who will condemn you. I do not. I despise you."
She screamed a torrent of abuse at him. Moulin clamped his broad hand across her face until she gagged and quietened.
"Don't smother her. Let her breathe."
No sooner had Moulin's hand released her than she drew breath and cursed Blackstone again. The throat-cutter went to strike her, but Blackstone stayed his hand.
"She's a creature who won't be silenced until the devil takes her back to his fold." It's time we left this place of misery. How many more nights would they have to spend here before Alain was able to travel? He had once thought Felice to be the name of a woman, but in reality it was a place of torture and death, ruled by a voracious she-wolf. Cade was dead, and Griffith ap Madoc would soon be found. He nodded at Moulin. Keep men at her door. Search her servants each time they enter. She has keys of her own, and there's another door. Look in her bedchamber. Block it. She is to be kept inside.
I will curse you, Thomas Blackstone, every day you live, she said.
And your voice will join the multitude of others.
I swear I will be there when you are caught and your limbs are severed from your body and your ugly scarred head is on a spike at the gates of Paris, she hissed through bared teeth.
Be sure that my eyes gaze on you, Countess. I would want to see the withered hag that you become, old, bent and crippled. Your wanton life will wither you. Your shriveled skin and toothless gums will give flight to what beauty you have today. He smiled. I have no such journey to make. My face will never be my fortune.
Chapter 56
Dank mist clung to the countryside around Vincennes. The Seine seemed to suck the grey air down to its surface, as if reluctant to relinquish its smothering blanket. The Dauphin sat hunched in an ermine-lined robe, his feet pushed towards the blazing fire. No matter how warmly he dressed, the chill would not leave his bones. He ached, and his nose dripped. His watery eyes gazed at the blurred flames, and he craved the warmth that summer would bring, knowing he would be happy to endure the suffocating heat. But this was only the middle of February, and the trees stubbornly refused to leaf and herald the approaching spring. The French army had made progress, sweeping aside some of the routier bands. The army's ranks had swelled to 4,000 after extra taxation had been imposed by the king. Men from the eastern provinces had been united under Jean de Tancarville's command, and they had begun their march south, while those under Arnold de Audrehem's command scoured the Rhone Valley, digging the mercenaries out of their rat-holes and destroying them. The routiers would soon be crushed between the two armies. Simon Boussy entered the room and bowed. He was breathless.
"You wheeze like an old crone, Simon. This weather would put us all in an early grave."
"Sire," he said, as if agreeing. And then, "the king." Before Boussy could complete the sentence, the Dauphin arched upright in expectation.
"He is ill?"
Was that a note of hope in the Dauphin's voice? Wondered the king's counsellor.
"No, sire. The king is well."
He hesitated, expecting at least a sign of relief from the frail son. There was none. Charles remained passive, and, if anything, appeared to be irritated by the intrusion for anything less than his father's imminent collapse. The king had gone to claim Burgundy, and he had stayed in Dijon.
"No, Highness. But I am instructed to advise you of news that he has received."
"From Florence?" the Dauphin asked, again hopefully.
"No, sire. Nothing has been heard from there. Messengers have reached us about an attack on Chateau de Felice."
The Dauphin looked nonplussed.
"Where?" "Countess Catherine d'Aval, Count Henri's widow." "What concern are they to us?" "Count Henri was a loyal nobleman, Highness. He was slain by routiers 2 years or more ago. You allowed the Countess relief from taxation because she entrapped routiers, and for using—"
"William Cade."
"Exactly, Highness. Now Cade is dead."
"She killed him, even though he lured routiers behind her walls?"
Simon Boussy suppressed the sigh of exasperation. His face remained passive.
"Sire, Chateau de Felice was taken by Thomas Blackstone. His men burned and raped. Blackstone killed William Cade."
The Dauphin's face sagged.
"If Cade was tortured, he would have told Blackstone who sent him."
He gave it a moment's thought and shrugged.
"That is of no consequence."
What of the Countess?
One of the garrison men who escaped said that she was alive when he left, but Blackstone's men had pillaged and killed with abandon. It is not known whether she has survived.
It grieves us to think that a loyal widow, who waged her own war against these vermin, might succumb to the likes of Blackstone.
The Dauphin stood and tugged the cloak around him. He smiled.
Our father must take action against him. He has legitimate cause now.
There is more information that the king has not yet been made aware of. Nothing is yet clear, and we do not know whether the reports are first-hand, but, because the king desires to travel to Avignon, I thought you should be the first to hear what we have discovered, said Bussy, clearly enjoying the privilege of bearing important information. The Dauphin waited.
Are we to die of exhaustion awaiting your news?
Sire, our envoys travelled down the Rhone to ensure that the army had secured his route. Our people in Avignon report that Pope Innocent is ill, and in his weakened state we were fearful that he might grant an amnesty to the routiers who press close to the city walls. I was concerned for the king's ongoing comfort and safety. The Pope has excommunicated the mercenaries who demanded payment in return for raiding elsewhere, but we have heard that he has pardoned one group of brigands. The circumstances are not clear, and we do not know why, but there was word that they were Thomas Blackstone's men.
Bussy was gratified to see that the news focused the Dauphin's attention. He is in Avignon now? Said the Dauphin, shocked.
We are uncertain, but his name was heard many times. We assume it to be true.
The Pope has pardoned him and his men?
It would appear so.
Why would he go to Avignon?
The Dauphin considered the possibilities.
Unless he is leaving France to go to Italy.
You say we have heard nothing about his son in Florence? But is it possible that Blackstone has?
Is he retreating to Italy to be with his son?
It is doubtful, sire. Our sources say his men are riding north from Avignon.
Here? Or do they intend to invade Burgundy? It is a prize the English failed to secure in the past.
We do not understand.
Our northern army is between the king and them.
Other routiers gnaw at the edge of Burgundy, Highness. If he is joining these others, then they might be arriving in force.
The Dauphin fell silent.
Thoughts of Blackstone demanded concentration.
If our father places a bounty on Blackstone now, and the Pope has granted a pardon, does that not cause a conflict between the Holy Father and ourselves?
Bussy hesitated.
Let the young Dauphin see that he, the wise counsellor, thought deeply on the matter before answering.
As always, it added weight. Not if Pope Innocent was pressured to do so, he said, as if he had considered the ramifications. In fact, he knew already that no such conflict would exist should the King of France bring the weight of his authority to bear against Blackstone.
If the Pope lies sick, and there are brigands at the gates of Avignon, then what value can there be in granting such a pardon? It does not absolve Blackstone from rape and murder and further atrocities.
There is also rumour that before Chateau de Felice, and after he destroyed Saint-Aubin, he and a marauding band struck at Saint-Bernice-de-la-Grave.
There was a great slaughter and mutilation of the worst kind, and it appears the young son, Alain de la Grave, was taken hostage. Nothing is known of his welfare.
The Dauphin's parchment skin creased into a smile.
I laid traps for Blackstone, and my plan in Florence to kill his son and blame the Visconti might still bear success. But now Blackstone places his head in a noose of his own choosing. He will find no favour now with Edward. He can no longer serve the English king and secure the town ceded under the treaty. Here is proof that he has taken matters into his own hands and benefits as much as any common mercenary.
Bussy watched the agitated Dauphin stand and pace back and forth, fists clenched.
Sire, hardly proof. May I beg to remind you that all of this is only rumour, that a messenger from Chateau de Felice might be exaggerating events there.
Yes, of course, we know Blackstone sacked Saint-Aubin, but as to the rest of it... The Dauphin glared at Bussy.
Rumour serves our purpose. Told convincingly enough, it becomes truth.
And dare we deceive King Edward, if he discovers that
Edward has forced a foul treaty on our father?
The Dauphin interrupted.
We fought that treaty with you at our side. We denied Edward even more territory. We will take France back one day. But if there is an opportunity to impugn Blackstone in the eyes of his king, then we will not hesitate.
The Dauphin had found a new energy and strode from the room with a subservient but worried Simon Bussy in his wake.
Merciful Christ, Bussy prayed quietly. Grant those who labour to restrain an impetuous king-in-waiting the ability to control his actions.
The Dauphin sought satisfaction against Thomas Blackstone with an unquenchable thirst. But if the allegations against the scar-faced knight were proved to be nothing more than exaggerated tales, and the all-powerful English king learnt of it, then Edward would find a way to inflict further punishment and humiliation on the French crown. He would decide that the French were undermining the treaty. Bussy followed the man, to whom he had committed his loyalty, to a room where a dozen courtiers and advisers waited, and clerks had quill and parchment ready.
"We desire that word be taken to our father, bearing news of Thomas Blackstone."
The clerks started writing, as the Dauphin settled himself by the fireplace, and a servant poured him wine.
"There is now sufficient evidence that King Edward employs a mercenary knight who hides behind the official duties imposed by his own king," said the Dauphin.
He glanced at the gathered courtiers.
"It would not be the first time that Thomas Blackstone has defied his monarch."
He saw the clerks scratching away.
"No, no, do not write that."
He gestured at the clerks to wait, and then signalled he was ready to dictate again.
"We entreat our beloved father to summon Sir John Chandos and deliver a formal writ of complaint. We implore him to send word to the English king that the atrocities committed by Thomas Blackstone will be a cause of concern to him, and that we will pursue such criminal and foul activities in defence of our treaty."
He raised a hand to stop the scribe's writing.
"Edward has vowed to rid us of these brigands. He cannot in good conscience employ this mercenary in his service."
The Dauphin glanced at Bussy.
"We will bring Edward's force against Blackstone as well as our own."
Bussy felt a grudging respect for the ailing Dauphin. He had thrown a wide net to entrap Thomas Blackstone, and even if each attempt failed, he now reached into the very heart of England, and was in effect blackmailing Edward. The English king could not object to the French hunting down his own chosen captain, and if Edward feared his will had been thwarted by a rogue knight who had placed the treaty in jeopardy, then he would have his chosen commander, Chandos, stop Blackstone. The physically weak Dauphin might spend his days in his library rather than enjoying the hunt at the king's side, but his mind was agile and as cunning as a rodent, finding its way into the grain store. Perhaps, Bussy dared to think, when the Dauphin Charles came to the throne, he would be known as the Rat King. Chapter 57 The Gascon captain, Bayard, had led Fra Foresti and Henry Blackstone out of Avignon, as Niccolo Torellini remained to recuperate from the arduous journey across the Alps. That a loyal captain serving Blackstone had arrived in the same place as Torellini's foothold in southern France could only be an act of God, and that Bayard had been sent by Blackstone to recruit more men gave the old priest even more comfort. But the sooner Bayard departed from Avignon, where whispers travelled more quickly than the wind, the better. If Blackstone and his small band of men were less than 10 days away, then his son could be delivered safely, and with more protection than Torellini could have hoped for. Once he had secured the Pope's pardon for the Gascons under Bayard's command, he embraced the son of the man whom God and fate had brought into his life.
"Tell your father that I send him my heartfelt wishes, and that I beg his forgiveness for allowing you to be placed in danger while in my care," he told Henry.
"Father Torellini, my father would never bear you any ill will. It is I who must beg your forgiveness, because my presence in Florence caused an attack to be made on me,
and that you have been obliged to journey so far from the comfort of your home.
A gracious answer, my boy. You have been educated by the finest minds, and you have learned the good manners and the importance of respect. But you have also been close to death before, and forced to defend yourself, and I know you do not take killing lightly. But your journey is not yet over, and you may once again be required to take your sword in hand. It is then, as happened in that street in Florence, that you must set aside the laws of reason and the language and emotion of the schoolroom, and defend yourself.
I am in good hands, Father Torellini, said Henry, acknowledging the two men who were now his guardians for his onward journey to his father. Bayard gathered the men he had recruited, but made no mention who it was that travelled with them. It was enough for them to know that the town knight had promised to escort the young man in his charge to Canterbury on pilgrimage. As they rode cautiously towards the agreed meeting place with Blackstone, they saw increasing signs of French troops on the banks of the Rhone. More men were gathering than they had seen before, and if the French army was marching from the north to entrap the mercenary bands, then their ranks would soon be swelled by these thousands of men moving up from the south.
"Do we make ourselves known to the French?" asked Henry.
"No, we have had skirmishes with them. We did not know whether their attack was deliberate or whether they mistook Sir Thomas and thought us a band of routiers.
If my father serves the king, and there's a treaty, then why would they now wish to deliberately attack him?
The French would bring King Edward's scorn and anger upon them." Bayard looked with uncertainty at the town knight. How best to answer the boy?
"He has a point," said Fra Foresti. "If you and these men cannot appeal to the French for further protection, then that means you are fearful of them. But it seems impossible that we will be able to avoid them on this journey."
"Avoid them we must, Brother Foresti, and Master Blackstone is correct. We might be mistaken about their intent, but it is my opinion we would be safer in Routier hands than with the French. The war was won, but a treaty can be tested. Who knows what Edward might sacrifice to see his ceded lands brought under his control? A king would not lose sleep over the loss of one of his captains, if it meant keeping hold of peace."
"Then we are thankful that good fortune has brought you to us," said Fra Foresti.
Bayard wasn't listening. His attention had been caught by his outriders, who urged their horses from the high ground ahead. He spurred his own horse away from the town knight and Henry, but the Gascon's sense of urgency was infectious, and the column of men quickly followed. Bayard heard only a few words of his outriders' report, and then, wheeling his horse, followed them at the canter. They crested the ridge and looked across the valley below. On the far side, 1,000 yards distant, he saw fluttering banners and a mass of men. They were moving across a battlefield. His eyes swept the expanse beneath them. Hundreds of corpses littered the field. The killing must have ended only hours before. Loose horses stood and grazed, ignoring the twisted dead. Others had fallen alongside their riders. It looked to have been a sudden confrontation. "French army," said Bayard, as the other men caught up. He pointed to the indistinct huddle of men in the distance.
"Routiers," said one of his outriders, "caught like rats.
They came down that plain between the hills and the river and had nowhere to run," said another man-at-arms.
"Bayard," called one of the Gascons from down the line of men who were gazing at the slaughter, "look sharp."
The town knight and Bayard looked to where the man pointed. Horsemen, several hundred yards away, were riding hard towards them.
"Rear guard ready to kill stragglers," Bayard shouted. "Too many. We must outrun them."
He yanked his horse around and spurred it towards the higher ground that lay 2 or 3 miles away. If they could make the rocky, forested heights, their pursuers might have second thoughts about attacking them uphill. Bayard realized that if they survived, they would need to find sanctuary behind the walls of a town, because the countryside was crawling with determined French troops. And if Blackstone was traveling towards their rendezvous, then he too was riding into an overwhelming force. But there was no way he could be warned. He looked across to where the town knight and Henry Blackstone whipped their horses. At least the boy could ride.
The test would come if the outnumbered men were obliged to fight. Bayard did not wish to be the man who told Thomas Blackstone that his son lay dead in a sodden field of blood. Chapter 58 Blackstone had suppressed his impatience and desire to be free of the Countess and Felice. The apothecary had pleaded with him to delay his departure so that Alain had a chance to survive the butchery on his leg. So Blackstone had delayed, waited and kept the men sharp once their wounds were healed, for Griffith, at Madoc's camp in the mountains, would likely be a stronghold that would take its toll on Blackstone's men in an attack. Patrols went out every day, but there was no sign of French troops making their way towards the chateau. Finally, at the end of the month, with bad weather looming, they took their leave. Blackstone's horsemen rode slowly through the gates of Chateau de Felice. The town's walls had no sentries. Felice was left to defend itself and its predatory Countess Catherine de Val as best it could, a depleted citadel that now had only its sheer walls to repel any invader. The blood-clogged mouth of William Cade gaped in a silent curse. His blind eyes, already taken by the crows, denied his departed soul the sight of the victor leading his men away to seek further retribution against Griffith ap Madoc. Cade's skull would rot, or the townspeople would cast it into the river. Either way, the time of the routiers at Felice had ended. Countess Catherine stood at her window, the fire in the grate cold, her gown loose, her skin puckered from the wind that swept down the valley. She wore no makeup, her hair was unkempt, her mind desperate. Every ambition to avenge her dead husband and children had been crushed by the Englishmen. Her town was defenceless, her people fearful, and she had nothing to comfort their grief. She watched as the line of horsemen faded into the distance. She had given Blackstone the Welshman's location. That Blackstone and his men would be outnumbered, and surely killed when the Englishman found the man he hunted, brought her no satisfaction. She had gambled and lost. How long would it be before the people in the town turned on her and sought out the gold that still remained? She was a defenceless woman, utterly alone. How could she carry on? She gazed down the sheer walls to the jagged rocks far below. It would take only a few terrified breaths before her body smashed into the gully. Then the barren life that beckoned, and the impending assault from her own people would be averted, and she would, at last, find some kind of peace by joining her husband and children. She raised her face to the wind and let it chastise her body a moment longer. Then she called to her servants to bathe her and prepare her finest clothes. She stepped away from the window and its temptation. A better day would come. Other men could be bought and power regained. Alain de la Grave lay tied onto a litter. Blackstone had kept the pace slow during the first day, and stopped frequently to attend to the young Frenchman. But he knew he could not pursue the Welshman or fend off any attack with the injured boys slowing them down. Given that they were carrying an invalid, Blackstone had decided to avoid taking the ceded town that he intended to secure for Edward, knowing that Bayard would by now be making his way northward with any men he had recruited. As they edged towards the monastery, he knew he had to risk the boy's life again. He would leave him in the care of Prior Albert, the man who had betrayed them. "Unless we meet Bayard coming north, we will have to leave word at the monastery," said Blackstone. "These scab-assed monks might smother the lad or let him rot," said Kildare. "I'll give them cause not to do that," said Blackstone, as they eased their mounts into the forest for the night. Kildare and Blackstone dismounted and pushed through the low ferns to where fallen trees and a rocky outcrop created a natural encampment. Kildare ran his hand across the velvet coat of the moss-covered deadwood. "Damned forests are always wet, Thomas. My bones ache from it. I have been denied the comfort of a feather mattress with a woman whose teats would please a wet nurse and any suckling babe. I thought myself well suited to the life of Lord of the Manor at Felice. My cock ached for her, and in time my heart would have come around as well. Now all I have are aching bones. A poor exchange." Blackstone tethered the bastard horse and pulled free the saddle. He tore a handful of ferns and rubbed its sweat-slicked back. Muscles quivered as it turned its oversized head, fixed its glare on him, and then shifted its weight. Blackstone moved carefully out of reach of the iron-shod hooves.
"Too many old wounds, Gilbert. All of us. Including him," he said, meaning the horse. "She would have gelded you one day, that or cut your throat, as she tried to do. She had an appetite for men. You would not have lasted long in her embrace."
"I was prepared to risk it. I am the same age as the king, and unlike him, I do not have many opportunities to wallow in comfort. She would have been a demanding woman, I know that, but I am up to such demands, and I have to confess that as far as my heart is concerned, she was more radiant than even my nun."
"The nun who fornicated with every monk in sight.
I forgave her once I broke their heads." "You don't understand women, Thomas. They have needs, like us. Imagine being cooped up in a convent or a chateau. Dear Christ, the boredom!"
"I pitied the Countess. What was there beyond embroidery and torturing routiers, eh? Sexual gratification tempers the soul and banishes boredom."
Blackstone finished hobbling the bastard horse. It snapped at his head as he bent to tie its front legs. He deftly avoided the yellow teeth, and despite its belligerence, ran an affectionate hand over its cheek.
"I was thinking we should go south after we've finished the king's business and dealt with the Welshman. Find an abandoned garrison somewhere near a monastery. Maybe find you another of your nuns. A place where the sun ripens the vines and the monks make good wine. Or perhaps even go back to Elfrid and the men outside Florence, or bring them to us. Elfrid is even older than you. He would settle for a quieter life now, I'll wager.
We should do it soon, Thomas. The king will continue to find us work more fit for tax collectors than fighting men."
He followed Blackstone's example and rubbed grass and fern over his horse's back.
"But the likes of you and me cannot stay idle for long. We were born to fight. What would life be without something to stir the blood? We should think about the Moors in Spain. The Spanish will pay us well. There are sea breezes and food enough for an army, and the winters down there are warm. None of this dank misery with thousands of skinners on one side of the river and thousands more Frenchmen on the other. Let them fight among themselves. The Moors have built palaces rich with gold. A couple of good years of plunder, and I could buy my own castle."
"And do what with it? Stand on its tower and survey your land, farm it, plant crops or vines?"
"Servants, Thomas. They do all the work. We sit back and enjoy the rewards of our efforts. Merciful God! We could have done this a dozen times already. Imagine, slave girls from the East, nuns from local monasteries, women from anywhere. I'm not fussy like you, Thomas. It's not my heart I offer them, and it's not for ever. Just long enough to rest and see which way the wind blows us to our next conflict."
Blackstone carried his saddle and blanket beneath the tumbling boulders. He found a patch of deep fern and crushed the plants beneath the blanket, then settled his saddle as a pillow. He undid his sword belt and wrapped it around Wolf's sword scabbard.
"I would ride away quietly, Gilbert, but there are too many enemies who await their chance to kill me. I'll rest when I'm dead."
"You need a woman," said Kildare, settling his own blanket down, and then, remembering the women Blackstone had known since his wife died,
"Perhaps not. You and women upset the order of the planets," he sighed. "I need a piss.
Think about what I said, though. Spain is warmer than Italy. The women are hairy, but they have no inhibitions. Not like some of these damned French women who think their cunning is a vault full of silver. No, a Spanish woman's skin is fragrant. Her hair is black like silk, glistening with sweet oils. We could do worse, if only for a couple of years. Three, perhaps. But I agree, no longer. Then, by God, we would be like armoured stallions, ready to fight the devil himself."
Kildare glanced down at Blackstone. The hard, seasoned knight, the boy he had dragged to war all those years past, lay curled in on himself, his breathing deep and regular as he slept. The veteran knight looked around as the men organised themselves. Years of campaigning meant they were sharp, every one of them, as keen as a honed blade. They knew what to do and when. Blackstone could lead an army of men like these, and every one of them was worth shedding blood for. In truth, he told himself, despite all his talk of castles and rich women, there was nowhere else he would rather be than among them. Chapter 59. On the slow journey back to the monastery, Blackstone had kept the injured Alain close by his own campfire, and through the nights made sure the young man had warmth and food. The amputated leg showed no sign of turning foul, but he had followed the apothecary's instructions and had the dressing changed each day. Now Blackstone and his men waited outside the monastery, Saint-André de Babignon, as John Jacob hammered his fist on the gate and rang the bell.
"Open it, you lovers of the Lord, or be prepared to meet him," he shouted.
Kildare shifted in his saddle. "Thomas, were it not for the lad and his need for care, would we have burnt this place to the ground for their treachery, and sent these pious lying bastards into the forest and hills, so that the wolves and bears might fill their bellies?" Blackstone grinned. "I would have sent the prior on a pilgrimage to Canterbury on his knees, and helped him on his way with a sack of pig fat on his back to help attract them." The leather-faced porter's head appeared in the viewing hatch. Blackstone and Kildare could hear the trembling voice from where they waited.
"He's afraid to give us entry," John Jacob called.
"Tell him he has no choice. We have an injured man. We claim sanctuary for him," Blackstone answered. Kildare sighed.
"We need to make better time, Thomas. Who knows if the Welshman is still at La Roche? He'll outnumber us, so we'll need to ride with caution once we're close."
"We are still refused," called John Jacob.
"Mother of God!"
groaned Kildare. He stood in his stirrups and bellowed,
"Open the gates, you Judas whores, or we'll send our men over the walls!"
John Jacob trudged back, shaking his head, to where his horse was held.
"The old gatekeeper has strict instructions from the prior."
"This is hardly the time to start a siege, Thomas. Let us scale these puny walls and teach them a lesson."
"Let's try the front gate first," said Blackstone, and nudged the bastard horse forward. As he reached the double wooden doors, he tugged the rein to bring the great warhorse's rump against them. Then he eased his weight in the saddle, and the horse obliged, pushing itself back, gathering strength, pressing its front legs into the dirt until its weight splintered any holding bar on the other side of the gates. Blackstone quickly turned the beast and forced his way through. The monks were gathered, huddled together for strength and confidence, but they soon broke and scattered as Blackstone urged the horse forward. Kildare, John Jacob, and Moulin followed, leaving the rest of the men at the open entrance. Blackstone dismounted and pushed his shoulder against the locked door that led to Prior Albert. It quickly gave, and once inside he strode down the passage and saw the prior running into his rooms. Blackstone heard a lock turn. He kicked at the handle, throwing open the door. The prior, shaking with fear, was on his knees before a simple crucifix on the wall. Blackstone grabbed him by the collar and threw him onto his cot. The weight of the man's body splintered the cot's legs, and Prior Albert slithered to the floor, his habit up around his waist.
"Get to your feet and cover yourself," said Blackstone.
As the prior scrabbled to adjust his habit, Kildare came into the room.
"I've sent Perrine into the kitchens," he pointed at the quivering prior. "You and your flea-bitten brothers are close to death. Do you wish to pray before we take our blades to you? Your countess won't be coming to help you this time. We killed all her men, and the routier scum she sent to ambush us. Did you think we wouldn't come back, brother betrayer? We offered you peace and goodwill. Now you'll pay with your lives."
Blackstone stepped forward and placed a restraining hand on Kilbert's shoulder.
"Now, Sir Gilbert, we caused Prior Albert's monks no harm, but he was likely frightened that we might have been skinners, not men on our king's business," he said, looking down on the kneeling prior.
"Yes, yes, I was convinced you were men like...
"William Cade," said Blackstone.
"Exactly,"
said the prior, seizing on the excuse.
"There, you see?" "He was fearful of his own doubts," Blackstone said to Kildare. "Like a man who doubts his own faith."
He looked at the prior. "Do you doubt your own faith?"
"I do not."
"Then you believe that the Almighty will protect you?"
"I do."
"And yet you lost your faith when we were first here.
Otherwise, why would you have betrayed us? The prior's mouth opened and closed as his thoughts raced for an answer.
He is a false believer. Kill him now and burn the place to the ground, Kilbert growled, taking a stride forward.
Blackstone restrained him again and turned to the prior. I am certain that if we grant these monks our mercy, they will offer their prayers for us and care for our wounded comrade. Is that not so, Prior Albert?
With all my heart, I swear that to be so.
Blackstone's body blocked the prior's view, so that he could not see Kilbert grin. Their little game of threat and the promise had worked. Kilbert stormed out of the room and turned with a final pointed gesture.
If he's lying, God himself will strike him and scorch this place from the face of the earth.
He turned away. Now, Blackstone said to the prior, hauling him to his feet, you will prepare the infirmary and instruct monks who are skilled in treating wounds. And then your kitchener will feed my men. Understood?
I will do everything you ask, and will pray for you.
Pray for yourself, Brother Prior. You still need forgiveness for your betrayal. The monks attended Alain de la Grave with gentleness. Clean sheets, covered with woolen blankets, and a fire in the infirmary, ensured his comfort. Herbs and ointments were prepared, and a wicker cage was placed over his amputated limb to keep the weight of the blankets from the wound. While Kilbert and the captains went about billeting the men and stabling the horses, Blackstone watched the monks go about their business. The young Frenchman was still gravely ill, but he was conscious.
"The monks will prepare a potion for your pain," he said.
"I am cast out of the world, Sir Thomas. I cannot serve you, and I can no longer serve myself. Better that I should have died,"
Alain said weakly. "No. Your courage demanded that we try to save you."
"Like this?" he said bitterly,
barely able to suppress his tears. "You are not a child, Alain. You will bear this like any fighting man. Your life has changed, but you have a life," Blackstone said sternly. "I have seen sturdier men than you die from amputation. You have fierce blood in your veins."
Alain tried to raise himself in the bed, but his strength had not yet returned. Blackstone resisted the urge to step forward and help him. Sweat blistered the young man's face. A monk, preparing fresh linen dressings across the room, moved to help him.
"No," Alain said. "Leave me."
The monk glanced at Blackstone, who gave a gentle shake of his head. The brother turned away and returned to his duties, while his young charge persevered and finally propped himself up.
"And what would you have me do with this half-life you condemn me to?" he demanded.
"What you did at Felice took courage. It will not desert you. Once that wound is healed, you'll use a crutch, and you will move as quickly as many men on two legs. I have seen men tie their half-leg by straps to a saddle. You'll be able to ride. You will do what you can, and make the best of it."
"I won't be able to fight," he insisted.
"No, likely not. But you are an educated man. There are towns and villages who need teachers. You might have only one leg, but you have a brain which is more than a lot of fighting men have."
They fell silent. Blackstone went to him and touched his arm.
"We are riding south tomorrow to seize and kill Griffith ap Madoc. I could not leave you at Felice, so here is where you will stay until you are healed, no matter how long it takes. No harm will come to you here, and when my business is done, I will look for you again."
Alain nodded, but Blackstone could see his words offered no comfort.
"You are stricken, Alain, but that does not make you any less a man."
"How are you so certain?" he answered. "How can you know?"
"Before we arrived at Saint-Banis and found you, I spoke to a man cursed with leprosy. He guided us through the forest near your town. He had served King John, and years ago fought us at Poitiers. But the leprosy brought him to his knees. His family was taken from him. The son he loved was raised by another man. He understood that despite the pain of that loss, he had no choice but to accept it. He was one of the bravest men I have met, and he lives his life with fortitude and courage."
As Blackstone quietly told the story, he thought he saw in Alain's eyes a glimmer of some lost childhood memory.
"His name was Robert de Rabastin. He was your father."
Disbelief gripped the young Frenchman. Finally, he stared at Blackstone, his voice strained.
My father was Mouton de la Grave, lord of Saint-Benis.
He honored Robert de Rabastens and took you to his heart. Now you must honor both these brave men. A tear spilled from Alain's eyes. He quickly wiped it away and regained his composure. Honor is all we have left to us, said Blackstone. Find where yours lies. Hold it close, and let it serve you. Chapter 60 The men and horses were rested and fed, and after the prior had prayed for them, they left. Behind them, the prime bell for morning prayers rang out across the rocky hillsides. Blackstone did not look back. What lay behind a man was past. It was Kilbert who turned and glanced at the monastery as the column of men meandered across the valley track. "I hope the lad survives. It feels unusual not having him with us." "I thought you found him a burden," said Blackstone. "God's tears, Thomas. I found you a damned burden when you were a clumsy oaf that I first took to war, but I persevered." Blackstone smiled. "He'll survive. He has youth on his side, and he has the urge to live. I told him about his father. He thought him dead." "Aye, well, a leper is the living dead." Kilbert crossed himself. "I will die with a sword in my hand or with a woman in my bed, God willing," he shrugged. "But it seems likely that the way ahead will not offer me the choice. If the French have heard about Felice, then they will have an excuse to hunt us."
"They don't need an excuse," said Blackstone. "It will soon be a time of reckoning, Gilbert. One way or the other, we will not be able to avoid the French army."
Kilbert snorted and spat. "Then just as well I ploughed a furrow with the Countess." It took 3 days of steady riding for Blackstone's men to reach the Loire, and another to find a ford. Blackstone and his men had skirted the broad, swirling river with its treacherous currents and sinking mud, until coming across a broad, shallow expanse of the waterway. They sat in their saddles 200 yards from the bank, in cover behind a village of huddled, reed-thatched houses, waiting to see if the crossing was safe. There had been no sign of riders on the far bank, but the bulrushes that grew in the shallow's mud and the trees beyond could easily hide an enemy.
"This is the best we will get, Thomas," said Kilbert. "But who's to say local troops don't use it to go back and forth?"
Blackstone studied the muddied banks and approached to the ford as the air from the river was swept onto them by the northerly wind.
"Cow shit," he said. "Smell it?"
Kilbert wrinkled his nose.
"I thought that was Will Longdon and his archers."
"Aye, Sir Gilbert," said Will Longdon from further along the line of horsemen. "But when archers fart, men die, and you are still in the saddle."
"And I've a mind to have your scab-arsed archers swim across further upstream, to see if your foundering draws any attention from an enemy on the far side."
Blackstone pointed beyond the village to the ford.
"It's shallow enough for local villagers to herd the cattle across, so there must be grassland on the other side. There's nothing but forest here."
The wind carried no sound of voices, only the flitting smoke from the hovels' roofs and the gentle baying of cattle. Then herdsmen appeared from beyond the houses and began to whip a dozen cows across the ford. Blackstone and Kilbert watched as the men waded knee-deep, their cries urging the cattle forward easily audible, but no soldiers appeared on the far bank to establish who it was that called out. Blackstone led his men forward to follow the cattle herders. The Villeins were alarmed at seeing armed horsemen suddenly splash into the shallows behind them, yet they had no choice but to hasten the cattle and let them scramble ashore wherever they may. Blackstone's men rode among them, using the cows' splashing hooves and ululating panic to smother their own heavy hoofbeats. Anyone hidden beyond the river bank would have their guard lowered by the usual sound of the villagers bringing across their livestock. The men spurred their horses on, swords drawn against any troops who might be guarding the crossing unseen. Once up the bank, the men saw a stretch of open meadow that led to wooded rising ground, but the pasture was trampled, as if a column of horsemen had cut across it and merged into the forest.
"Thomas! Our flank!" Kilbert called.
There was a surge of activity in the tree line, and men stumbled into the open. They were foot soldiers, and no more than 30 of them. They were French regular troops, a contingent of infantry, who would have been part of a larger group of scouts or raiders. It was unlikely that they were alone without mounted men-at-arms in support. Blackstone wheeled the bastard horse away, hesitating to strike at such hardened men, even though they had been taken by surprise. His men veered and quickly reformed 40 yards from the foot soldiers, who crouched clear.